It has never been easy for me to imagine this, but when he was not preaching, the Apostle Paul made tents. It helped him earn a living. I'm sure he learned something from it. Patience, perhaps, to deal with his troubled young churches. I was editor of a daily newspaper once to help earn a living in a small town where somebody was always in jail over the weekend for what was called disturbing the peace. It was almost always a euphemism for being drunk, and the person would be let out after a night behind bars. Paul himself was arrested several times on that same charge, disturbing the peace, but it was not drunkenness. It was religious and political agitation, and it was no harmless weekend offense. We can read the charges as they have been preserved in the book of Acts. We have found this man to be a perfect pest, a fomenter of discord among the Jews all over the world, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. I think it's humbling and chastening to realize that is how we started. The sect of the Nazarenes. Strange little off-color group sprung out of Judaism somehow. The charge closes by saying he even tried to profane the temple, but we arrested him. It was on a charge like this that Paul was in jail when he wrote the letter we started to read last Sunday. It was dangerous. If it were proved, Paul could be put to death. He understood the gravity of his predicament, but he looked for good in it, and he found some. Let's read a little more of his letter. Not, I hope, as a piece of dead history, but as a model for our own response to defeat and disappointment. We hear him still in the preface, being unusually affectionate. It is only natural that I should feel like this about you, he says. You are very dear to me. God knows how much I long with the deepest Christian love and affection for your companionship. My prayer for you, not for himself first, but for them, my prayer for you is that your love may grow richer and richer in knowledge and insight of every kind. We do not often couple love with words like knowledge and insight. I talk to parents who confess that they have loved, but not wisely, that they have failed to have much insight into what their children felt and thought. They would certainly understand what a marvelous gift Paul wants for these Philippians and for us. But now the warm hello is over, and we get down to some of the specific reasons for writing. What will be the effect on Paul's friends of his being in jail? People have always rather liked to think of religion as a form of insurance. Pray a lot, go to church, and God will protect you. On American television, you can hear an amazing quid pro quo religion, compensation in kind. Put a dollar in the plate, and God will multiply it by 10. Paul's gospel wasn't even remotely like that. But even so, some of his friends were surely thinking, Is this what may happen to us for believing? So without denying for a moment how close to death he was, he still tried to give them courage by finding something good in what had happened to him. My being in jail, he tells them, has actually advanced the Christian faith. Some of the people around town have been made much bolder about speaking the word. Apparently, they were saying to each other, with Paul in jail, it's up to us. We have to pick up the slack and work harder than ever. So whatever else might be bad, that at least he could rejoice in. Is there a word for us in Paul's experience? I think every one of us in this room is in some kind of prison, a habit we don't like, but can't seem to break free of, a job that shackles us. Certainly, we're all in the prison of our own personalities. We know how nearly impossible it is to get free of some of our lifelong defects. We may have said 100 times, I don't know why I do that. I just keep getting myself in trouble. I hurt people I don't want to hurt. But the chains have grown thick over the years, and we really do seem sentenced to make some of the same mistakes over and over. It's right to regret that, but even being the prisoners of our own personalities is not all bad. It also means that we are in bondage to certain ideas of what is good and decent, taken captive a long time ago when we were still children, and we can be glad for those constraints, especially when we so often act on impulse. Some of us do the right thing simply because we were captured early in life by the notion that we must. So even determinism is not all bad. Paul, I'm happy to say, is never a Pollyanna. Things weren't all good. There were some other people in town who he said were speaking the word also with him in jail, except that they were doing it out of rivalry with him, envious, apparently, of his success, and eager to get ahead of him in reputation now that he is in prison. How sad we think that it should happen so soon in early Christian history, but it's hardly a surprise. We're not strangers to envy, to that sense of pleasure over the failure of somebody else's program, or the decline of a rival church. In a culture which demands that we think about winners and losers, and determines those categories by head counts, we probably rejoice for the wrong reason when people defect from other churches to ours. So, how does Paul react to rivals who are taking unfair advantage of his being locked up? What model does he give us for knowing how to respond in those moments when our worst self may be tempted? Well, he says something that in English has been translated, what does it matter? What matters is that whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. They may have the wrong motive, but they're getting the word around. I can assure you that the four words, "What does it matter?" can be sometimes the most liberating words you can speak. Some of us never learn to say them about the right things. There are issues, obviously, that matter tremendously, and it would be cowardly and wrong not to confront them. But in a great many other cases, the best thing we can say is, "What does it matter?" Sign of a glorious freedom from conceit and pride. Paul seems to have done it without help, visible help at least. Most of us need a friend or a wife or a husband to make us remember those four words. Isn't it true that almost invariably when someone close to us says in the middle of our truly silly eruptions of wounded ego, "What does it matter?" it turns out to be the best medicine in the world. I don't always like Paul, but I like him very much when he is free in that prison to say, "What does it matter?" And this is a good moment, I suppose, for saying that Paul was actually free in all sorts of ways. You must have read the poem by now. "Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Minds that are innocent and untroubled can turn a prison into a kind of retreat." That is, the poet says, if they have freedom in their love. And Paul did. He was free to love even his rivals, even the people who didn't like him. And he authenticated the faith he preached by doing that. Still writing out of intense emotion, he has now an odd debate with himself. It gets underway after he says, "I hope that Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or death." Translation: "I hope I won't disgrace him, whether they let me live or whether they march me out to die." His language in Greek, sentences are disjointed. It is very hard as he goes on to be sure of exactly what he is trying to say. Rarely is Paul so deeply in the grip of his feeling. He writes the famous line, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I go on living, I will go on telling people about this way of life. If I die, I'm free of the beatings and insults and imprisonments. And if I die well, I honor Christ in my death just as I have tried to honor him in my life." We are probably right now inside the secret room of Paul's strength. He had no doubts at all about what his life was about, so long as he had possession of it. Not everybody is so lucky. In my office one day in St. Louis, the desperate attorney said, "My trouble is that I have no reason to live. Family gone, job lost, no close friends, I have no reason to live. I wanted to help, but I was being pulled into agreement with him. He didn't seem to have any reason to live. Paul's strength in that prison came, I am positive, because he did have a reason. For me to live is Christ. Now, I don't know whether that makes you squirm a little as good level-headed congregationalists, but it needn't. It isn't warm syrup and runny butter and a sticky pietism that makes you feel slightly nauseated. The last thing in the world Paul meant was that he was wrapped up in the arms of somebody sweet with a fragrant beard and a halo around his head who will not let anything bad happen to him. After all, he's in jail again. His life, since he met this Christ he talks about, has been a catalog of persecution and suffering. I can bear to hear a man say, for me to live is Christ, if the man has lived like Paul. It may be hard from a television evangelist who says it from a shiny, well-fed face, but not from a man who has had his back cut open with whips, has been stoned and shipwrecked and hungry and hauled into prison over and over, then I can listen. It isn't just a pretty little platitude anymore. Paul goes on thinking out loud about his dilemma. If I stay alive, that means I go on preaching. If I depart life, I am with Christ in some other mystical way. Which shall I choose? Did you really hear that last incredible statement? Which shall I choose? As if the decision belonged to him. On one level, as he knows perfectly well, he has no part at all in the decision. The Romans will decide. But on some other level, he simply cannot acknowledge that he is helpless. He can, after all, embrace his future, whatever it is. He can be on top rather than beneath what is happening. Confident, as he says in another letter, that nothing can separate him from the love of Christ, either life or death can be useful. So which shall he choose? This amazingly arrogant man, who is at the same time so submissive. He seems to prefer death for a moment, but he is first, last, and always a preacher. So he ends with a word of certainty. I know I shall stay alive and come to see you. Martyrdom, he has decided, is a luxury that will have to wait. Is Paul kidding us? Does he really think he has this choice in his own hands and has now settled it? Well, it seems settled, but let me give you a word of caution about how to read such a letter, in fact, about how to read much of the Bible. Paul is going to come to see us, the Philippians tell each other excitedly as they read what he wrote. He says he knows. They sigh with relief and happiness. But it is only a moment later that Paul is saying, Whether I come to see you or am absent, so he did not know. And later yet, if I am to be poured out as a kind of sacrifice, so he did not know. We have to learn how to read Scripture with all its changes of mood, its sudden turning, its wild faith that speaks in absolutes one moment, and the next is quite rational. I think what Paul is really doing is playing a serious little game in which he tries to decide what would be best if he were given a choice. Death would be welcome. He is old, he has suffered, he is tired. But then it occurs to him that this is selfish in its way. He is needed. So no matter how welcome that thought, he puts it behind him. He reminds me in this moment of that famous poem of Robert Frost's, in which a man pauses one night in his horse-drawn sleigh to watch the woods fill up with snow. It is a moment of almost irresistible beauty. The woods are lovely, dark and deep. One can almost feel the death wish. It would be nice in that snow-filled darkness to go to sleep. But someone is waiting for him in a town nearby. Someone needs him. So he puts the temptation out of mind. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. So must Paul have thought as he wondered what lay ahead for him, and in a kind of solemn play weighed the options as if the decision were truly his. For if it were, he knows what he would do. He would keep himself at God's disposal for the needs of his good friends back in Philippi. He had never met in person this master of his life. But he had learned the same strange and beautiful humility. Not my will, but thine. On that note, let's leave him until next week, when you will come, I hope, to hear him give the Philippians and us some intensely practical advice about how to meet certain problems of daily life. Until then, in the words of this letter, I say to you, none of you should think only of his own affairs, but each should learn to see things from other people's point of view. I can say those words with special confidence today, because each week, as groups of us meet to talk about our new church, I see strong-willed people learning how to see things from other people's point of view. It is the promise of a good and useful future. Amen.